Hi, and welcome to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court, the law, and the law of Trump, trademark. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I cover some of those things for Slate. This back half of April 2024 is, for the record books, to be sure. The first ever criminal trial of a former president got underway in New York City. The Supreme Court will hear back-to-back cases raising questions about whether trying to overturn a presidential election via a violent, sometimes lethal attack on the U.S. Capitol ought to carry consequences or invite accountability. And the highest court in the land will toss around the question of whether doctors should be required to wait around until pregnant patients are on the brink of death to intervene if that life-saving care involves an abortion. Our legal news cup runneth over. And in the midst of all this, dear listener, I am on the road and somewhat out of pocket this week, so I am lovingly placing you in the safe hands of Mark Joseph Stern, who is going to be catching up with Slate's chief law of Trump, trademark, correspondent, Jeremy Stahl, who has been sitting and bearing witness to the events taking place this week in Judge Juan Merchan's courtroom in Lower Manhattan, where former President Donald J. Trump has been metaphorically strapped to a chair during jury selection in that campaign finance slash hush money trial. But before I hand you over to Mark and Jeremy to chew over the events this week, two quick things. One, have you got your tickets for our live show in Washington, D.C. on May 14th yet? You're going to want to hop right on that. We are going to tackle one of the biggest questions that lurks over this entire Supreme Court term. How did this thing known as quote unquote originalism eat up the law, and what can we do about it? Mark and I are going to be on stage with a really exciting lineup of constitutional thinkers and scholars and doers. We would love for you to be a part of it. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets, slate.com/amicuslive. There's also going to be a link in the show notes. And the second thing, Slate Plus members, Mark and I will be in the Amicus Plus subscribers only cigar bar for your weekly dose of extra SCOTUS analysis this week. We have detached this extra feature. It now resides in a standalone episode just for you. And this week, we're talking about the January 6th case that the court heard this past week and a Title VII decision that came down that wasn't too horrible. If you are not a Slate Plus member, you might want to think about joining us. Not only will you unlock exclusive SCOTUS analysis in the bonus episodes of Amicus, but you will also be able to access ad-free listening across all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts by clicking Try Free at the top of our show page, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. And with that, Mark Joseph Stern, I am handing the reins over to you, my brother, and thank you.
Thanks, Dahlia. See you in the Amicus Plus cigar bar. Hi, I'm Mark Joseph Stern, senior legal writer for Slate and Dahlia Lithwick's wingman. And while Dahlia is, as she said, on the road and out of pocket, I am joining you on Maine to talk to Slate's jurisprudence editor, Jeremy Stahl, who has been in court in New York City these past few days, bearing witness to week one of President Donald J. Trump's first criminal trial. And it has been a week. Jeremy, welcome to Amicus.
Thank you, Mark. So happy to be here. So happy to be out of that freezing cold courtroom.
I'd love for you to start us off by taking us inside the courtroom where we all so badly want to be, napping or praying or otherwise. Can you maybe begin by painting a picture of where you are and where the former president is? Like, give us the Jeremy Stahl eye view of this.
So supposedly when the trial actually begins on Monday, I will be in the courtroom itself with the rest of the press watching the whole shebang from behind the defendant's table. The way it's worked the past few days, only six pool reporters, the people reporting for the entire country basically, have been in the courtroom itself, which is just packed with jurors, which we in the overflow room, which is where I am, can't see. What we can see are two TV monitors, one in the front of the room, a much nicer, better, like crisper one in the way back of the room for whatever reason. And we have a camera on Trump and the defense lawyers, a camera on the prosecutors, a camera on Judge Mershon, and a camera on where the voir dire questioning goes. But we have not been able to see any jurors. I did not get to go up and pat President Trump's hair and test its, you know, veracity. I would be in some sort of Secret Service situation right now instead of here if that were the case. But
you have the live cam. You're watching the reaction shots in real time.
Yes, that's right. It's a direct image of Trump as he listens to his lawyers try to pick apart jurors who are going to be judging him. And Judge Mershon rejecting their requests for cause removals left and right.
There are now 12 jurors seated. There will also need to be 6 alternates. And this election process has been tough. What are the biggest challenges?
It's gone surprisingly smoothly and surprisingly well and surprisingly quickly, to be totally honest. The way that the process was unfolding with 100 jurors entering the room, nearly 96 at the start of the day, and then more than half self-selecting out immediately, 50 to 60 saying, no, I can't do this, and then having to go through the remaining 30 to figure out who could plausibly be a juror in the case against Donald Trump. I was like, this is going to take so, so long. This is a Manhattan jury pool. They all read the New York Times. They all listen to NPR. Some of them, a couple, maybe have said they watched Fox News, but the media diets are all very not Trump-friendly. The district is not Trump friendly.
Right.
So the concern from Trump's attorneys is to find, and also to a certain extent for the prosecutors, less so maybe, but to find a jury that can sit in judgment of Donald Trump without having crazily strong opinions of Donald Trump. And if they do have any sort of opinion of Donald Trump, to just completely put that aside, that's a really big ask. That's a huge ask. One of the main questions in the jury questionnaire, question number 34, asks if you have strong opinions of President Trump and if you can set those aside and rule impartially in this case, if so. And that's the one that really, during voir dire itself, both sides were really, really hung up on and really, really fighting over.
So I think it's worth noting here that the reason this trial is happening in New York City is because Trump's alleged crime happened in New York City, right? And the Sixth Amendment says, as a general rule, defendants are to be prosecuted where they committed their alleged crime. So it's not as if Alvin Bragg, Manhattan District Attorney, figured out some sneaky way to reach out and grab Trump and slam him down in this courtroom in the middle of deep blue America. These jurors are representative of the community that surrounded Trump when he allegedly committed this felony offense, right?
Absolutely. And he has certainly had some friendly jurors. There were a handful of people who, you know, looked fondly back on his business career. One guy said he was a wannabe ice skater wannabe ice hockey player who was so grateful to him for rehabilitating the ice rink in Central Park back in the day. That guy was struck with peremptory challenge by the prosecution, by the way. But that is true. And what's also true is that Trump's legal team has been begging to get this moved elsewhere or to get jurors from outside of the city pulled in, like from Staten Island, from boroughs that might be slightly more favorable to the President Trump personally and politically. Judge Mershon, as he has done in a lot of these requests, was just like no dice. He's been saying basically no dice quite a lot to Trump's legal team in the first few days.
So you mentioned a peremptory strike. Before we get into the jury strikes, let's just sort of spell out for listeners the difference between a peremptory strike and a strike for cause, and maybe tell us a little bit how that's been playing out in the courtroom.
The way that a strike for cause works is if a juror was deceptive in their responses to the jury questionnaire or the individual voir dire from the two sets of attorneys, if they show a strong likelihood of bias, if those things apply to that juror, then the judge is supposed to remove them from the jury and not have them sit in judgment of Donald Trump in this case. And then after the two sides have made their requests for for-cause removals, they each had a set of 10 peremptory challenges. That is basically anything goes challenges where they can just remove jurors willy-nilly. For Trump, at least, it usually ended up being jurors that Trump tried to get bumped for cause and then failed at getting bumped for cause. He ended up having to waste a lot of peremptory challenges on people that had expressed something about him that he didn't like, and Judge Mershon let them on anyway. That was basically how the last, you know, few days have played out in getting to this full jury and then a series of alternates that are Going to be ready on Monday.
So we should just footnote that too, with the note that you can't use a peremptory strike on the basis of race or sex, right? That's the Batson challenge in those line of cases. But it doesn't sound like that's been an issue at all so far. Is that right?
Yes. I'm glad you clarified that. And we had this issue with, and I did this, and a couple of other publications did this, where we published the workplace of a juror, somebody who was seated. And in my case, my editors decided, you know what, let's take this out. Other publications left it up. Come what may, the juror was identified by family members almost immediately and removed themselves. But more to the point about Batson challenges, the judge at the start of Thursday warned the press, please stop identifying people by their jobs. In fact, he put out an order saying you can't identify people publicly by their jobs. But he also directed us not to describe the physical appearances and what we see and hear about and from jurors in the courtroom. Now, a Batson challenge is a challenge, you'd explain it better than I would, but it has to do with removing jurors just because of their race, right?
That's right.
You're not allowed to remove jurors just because of their race. But if the press can't identify jurors by the physical description that they see of their race, their ethnicity and all that, it's tough to see how that is like monitored, and it's really tough to see how we follow that. There was a lot of confusion in the press about how we actually follow that and like give the public what they need. And that speaks to the greater challenge of an anonymous jury situation as well.
Right. I think there's some real tension here because the Supreme Court has held, I think correctly, that generally the public has a right of access to trials, including voir dire. You know, the press typically has a right to report what's happening in open court. But here, Judge Merchan is cautioning you, don't say X, Y, and Z because it'll bust the anonymity of the jury. And I think you have two really important principles that are truly kind of in conflict there. The principle of having like a jury that can render an impartial verdict and remain safe from threats and physical violence, which we know is a problem for anyone who sits in judgment of Donald Trump, but also the press and the public's right to report on what's going on inside that courtroom. And as you gesture toward, Jeremy, I think like the press and public can serve as a watchdog when it comes to racial discrimination and peremptory strikes. So I'm curious how you feel you're going to sort of carry out or not carry out Judge Merchan's warning here.
Well, it seemed like the pool itself was self-censored, except for a couple of like, I don't know if they were braver reporters, but I was grateful that they were doing it. Some of the pool started self-censoring in terms of not describing people at least by race. But I think that's gonna resolve itself when the trial starts itself and more of the press are able to see who's on the jury, right?
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard, I think, also not to feel some sympathy for the jurors here. I'm thinking of the juror who walked away saying words to the effect of, I just couldn't do it, man. I mean, they are having their lives poured over, as we'll talk about, you know, by attorneys on both sides. They are being subject to extraordinary and unprecedented scrutiny. They're probably fearful of their physical safety. It does seem like a huge ask. I mean, serving on a jury is one of the sort of foundational elements of American citizenship. We all have to do it so that others would do it for us if we were, you know, in need of a trial. But this does seem like asking New Yorkers to do a whole lot in return for nothing but a pat on the back that they've fulfilled a duty of citizenship.
I don't know. Some of these people might get book deals out of this. So I don't know if it's for
cynical
nothing.
Cynical Jeremy.
I don't know if it's for nothing.
One thing that struck me is that the jurors, when questioned, have this like once in a lifetime opportunity to sit before Trump and insult him to his face, which seems like a fever dream of a resistance mind circa 2017, and now they can do it. How has that played out with jurors who just get up there and start trash-talking the former president?
Here's how it's played out. On the first and second day, there were a couple of jurors who, they were caught in the end, but they wanted to get on this pool for whatever reason, and they had strong anti-Trump animus, and they just refused to say their opinions. The first couple of days of the voir dire, it was Todd Blanche doing the questioning, and he was kind of like just tiptoeing around the issue and the question, do you have an opinion? But do you really have an opinion? Just basically eliciting it in the most meek kind of a way possible, even though I thought he was sympathetic and I liked him. And that didn't work at all. And many, many just filibustered him and did not answer their opinion. Literally. And then it came out that they had these Facebook posts saying lock him up or whatever. And it was like, no, you cannot be a juror. On Thursday, however, a pair of jurors, they were basically pushed very, very hard and very well by Susan Nicholas, the defense attorney doing voir dire for former President Trump. to share these views. One person said, he seems very selfish and self-serving. I don't really appreciate that from any public servant. That's how he portrays himself in public. It's not my cup of tea. Another one following off of that juror, another woman, in a kind of agreement with the previous juror, said, I think some of the ways he may carry himself in public leave something to be desired. And that was a funny way to express an opinion about Donald Trump, right? And it's like the most understated thing you could possibly do. Both of those jurors, by the way, made it onto the jury. That's juror number 11 and juror number 12 that I just told you about.
Wow.
I believe Trump's team tried to have them removed for cause and it was no dice. And they were out of peremptory challenges, so they just got stuck with those two.
Time for a short break to hear from some of our sponsors. You're listening to Amicus, Slate's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court and the law. I'm Mark Joseph Stern, talking with Slate's jurisprudence editor Jeremy Stahl about week one of former President Trump's criminal hush money trial. So you've got a live stream of Trump's face as all of this is happening. What is his reaction, or does he just stay stone-faced?
So he is pretty stone-faced. He's pretty dour and just grim and glum-looking and he's kind of hunched a little bit. I don't know if his attorneys have tried to offer him any more advice to present himself a little bit more, pleasantly in front of the jury. He did get warned because there was a juror who had posted on Facebook the day that Biden was announced the winner of the presidency by the media. She posted a video of the celebrations in New York that day and was like, spread the honking cheer or something like that. Very anodyne, though. And then Judge Marchand was like pretty skeptical of their claims that that was a for-cause removal. She ended up getting removed via peremptory challenge. But the point is that when they brought her back up for questioning about those Facebook posts, apparently Trump was muttering and scowling and grimacing at her and just being ugly towards her. And Judge Marchand, immediately after she got off the stand and went back into the jury room, was just like, I will not have this. There will be no intimidating witnesses in my courtroom. Make sure your client doesn't do that again, basically. And he hasn't, that I've noticed. It happened that one time, and it was bad, and he got scolded like a second grader or something like that who is doing spitballs in the back of the classroom. And it worked, to my eyes. So far.
I want to ask you, Jeremy, about one particular moment that caught my eye that was reported by Jonah Bromwich of the New York Times. He wrote, Todd Blanche, a defense lawyer for Trump, asked for the names of the first three witnesses before proceedings ended for the day, but a prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, refused to provide them, saying it's a courtesy they normally extend, but, quote, Mr. Trump has been tweeting about the witnesses. The judge responded, I can't fault them for that. Blanche asks what would happen if he could guarantee that his client would not reveal the names of the witnesses, and the judge responded, I don't think you can make that representation. What did you make of that?
Trump has been his own worst enemy in this courtroom. The incident I previously talked about where he was scowling and being intimidating towards the juror. But there's also on Tuesday a scheduled hearing over whether or not to hold Trump in contempt of court already. because Monday morning, when he was apparently in the courtroom, he was sending out a post about Michael Cohen at like 9 in the morning when he should have been in the courthouse at least, or on the doorstep of the courthouse or whatever. And he's done more since then. And so the DA has asked that he be held in contempt, that he be fined, I think, $1,000 per violation. And there's more than a half dozen of these violations. So he's done this in the first week of his trial, right? In front of the judge. It's not surprising that the judge is responding by saying, you know what? I'm not going to make the DA do anything they don't want to do. You're here because of who you are and you've put yourself in this situation.
So can we stipulate that if this were like any other defendant, he would have already been held in contempt of court probably 3 or 4 times?
Oh, in multiple cases. Let's stipulate that he would have been held in contempt. He might have had his bond revoked. He might be in a jail cell right now. And that's the other thing is that, when Trump has previously made the case about a selective prosecution process and the unfairness of the system, et cetera, he is getting the celebrity treatment. I'll just say that. Minimally, you can say that he's getting the celebrity treatment.
As our conversation shows, this case has a lot of unique, super weird challenges because this is a Trump trial, but there are also going to be some more predictable legal obstacles. What challenges do you foresee in the weeks ahead that might be involved in proving this case?
There's a couple of big things I'll say. One, on the first couple of days of jury selection, two lawyers, including one civil litigator, were picked to be on the jury. Now, this could cut either way, but the case itself is this financial documents case, and the crime that he's charged with is basically filing false documents, correct? And that is a misdemeanor offense normally. But to turn it into a felony offense, the DA has this theory that the purpose of filing these false documents was to commit another number of crimes: federal election campaign violations, New York campaign violations, tax violations, basically doing a hush money scheme to help him win an election and not have it look like part of a campaign contribution, correct? So that is a very complex set of legal steps and ladders potentially for a juror to wrap their heads around. And there is this risk, again, for either side, that a pack, a number of the jurors, look to those lawyers, look to one or both of those lawyers and say, whatever he thinks, I'm going to think, because he knows the law and I don't, right? So that is a risk for prosecutors. It's also potentially a risk for the defense attorneys. But Manhattan used to not have, either in the 80s or 90s, they used to not let lawyers go on criminal juries. They changed that, and now, like, it felt like every other person in the jury pool was a lawyer. One of the potential jurors, now that I'm recalling, was a member of the Brooklyn District Attorney's office. And it was just like, just one after the other after the other. And it was like, maybe it was inevitable that they got a couple of these lawyers on the jury.
Yeah, my dad is a law professor, and every time he's called for jury duty, he knows the defense attorney, the prosecutor, the judge, everybody in the courtroom. They all say, "Hi, Professor Stern," and then he is swiftly kicked out. This sounds like not too different, certainly from DC jury duty, where we are all lawyers. Of course, a jury deliberation room is a black box, right? If the other jurors decide they just want to follow the lead of the lawyers, they're allowed to do that. And so, as you say, it sounds like it is a gamble for either side. Like, do we think these lawyers will lead them to our position or the other one? There's no way of knowing. That's just how you roll the dice when you're trying to shape a jury.
Yeah, and neither side had any seeming objections to those two.
I wrote a mea culpa earlier this week, or more accurately, a piece about why I've changed my mind about this case over the last year, as we've seen more developments, more filings and arguments. Basically, you know, I didn't love this prosecution when the indictment came down, but I've come around, and now I think it's a strong legal theory and an important charge to bring. Where are you these days on the wisdom of this case, Jeremy?
I always felt good about this case, right? I always felt good from the start. And I had a lot of really, really incredibly smart and people who I appreciate, respect, friends like yourself, saying different things, right? So I understood the different positions. And on the one hand, it was this argument that this is too complex of a case, this is too old of a case, this is too stale of a case, and that the legal theory requires a judge, jury, appellate judges eventually to go through too many hoops to connect this financial documents fraud to a campaign finance crime that is never charged and never brought and is done as a federal election crime as well as a New York crime. It's just too much and it just won't work. And then the other case, the case that I really, really strongly felt and do strongly still feel to a large extent is, you know what, if this case was good enough for Michael Cohen to go down, Michael Cohen was brought down by these charges, right? Federal campaign finance charges were brought against Donald Trump's attorney. He went to prison. He was in home confinement and prison. He had other charges against him, but this was one of the big prongs of the case that he confessed to and the charges against this man. And if it was good enough for that guy, seems like it should be plenty good enough for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations specifically relating to this payoff, am I right, in federal court?
That's correct. That is what I mean, is that, and in open court, he implicated Donald Trump as the person who caused him to make this hush money payment and do this illegal campaign contribution, though there's now fighting over. And it's true that in front of a jury, the prosecution is not going to be able to argue, well, because Michael Cohen says he's guilty, then Donald Trump is guilty. They can't do that, right? And there were some filings Thursday by the Trump legal team trying to make sure that the jury is instructed very, very well on this question, perhaps too well on this question, to not rely on Michael Cohen's guilty plea as meaningful of anything, essentially.
Which is, I think, correct as a matter of the rules of evidence in a criminal trial. But
absolutely.
I think that more broadly, there's this kind of weird thing with so many Trump cases where he's like unindicted co-conspirator number one, right? He's the principal behind the entire scheme and conspiracy, but it's his agents who wind up taking the fall, at least first. And here, Michael Cohen, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, was pleading guilty to crimes specifically pertaining to this payoff scheme in federal court. And now we have a jury impaneled that can't even hear about that because that's just how the rules of evidence happen to shake out.
They can hear about, they're going to be allowed to hear that there was a plea agreement on those counts.
Okay.
That there was wrangling over this at the start of the trial, and the judge was like, you can't disentangle which counts are which. If you're going to present him as somebody who's confessed to various crimes, you have to include all the crimes, right? So they get to hear it, but they also have to disregard it for the purposes of Donald Trump's guilt, which, as you said, is correct as a matter of law.
Right. And this does happen in jury trials. It probably sounds weird to folks who aren't super familiar, but jurors hear information and then are told you are not allowed to consider this, or you're allowed to consider this for matter A, but not matter B. And you're just supposed to trick your brain into compartmentalizing the materials. And I don't know if that actually happens, but let's dare to believe. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Amicus, Slate's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court and the law. I'm Mark Joseph Stern. Let's return to my conversation with jurisprudence editor Jeremy Stahl about the Trump campaign finance / hush money trial that got underway in New York City this week. I want to point you toward a piece in Slate.com that Dahlia Lithwick wrote with Anat Shankar Osorio on some of the misguided commentary on the polling around this trial. This idea that it won't sway many people, many voters, either way. Dahlia and Anat are arguing that misses the point, that there are very few gettable voters in this election. And while a lot of legal commentators may not love this case, like me 1 year ago, it might still remind weary citizens of what's at stake in this presidential election. They write that this trial, after all, changes the story from a tale of two old men, neither of whom they find appealing, into the possibility that a convicted criminal will be deciding which laws, if any, apply to him and everyone else. Your take?
So I'm taking this from the perspective of somebody who's been in a week of listening to jurors who are citizens and are voters, right?
Right.
And my feeling, and even if they're New York, they're obviously, you know, slanted in their opinions generally in terms of voters. My feeling is that when you hear jurors talk their way through what this means to A, hold Donald Trump to the same standard of justice as anyone else, therefore not treat him as above the law, but also presume that he is innocent until proven guilty, you can hear them really wrestling with the seriousness and the weight of the matter. They know how real this is. The problem for the public, I think, is that there's no cameras in these courtrooms, right? People are not going to see how serious this is. They're going to rely on secondary descriptions from people like me to feel and see that. And I just feel like viscerally, it's a harder thing to convey. I'm hopeful that it can be conveyed and that people can appreciate that, especially once there's a verdict. I think once there's a verdict, and even throughout the course of the trial, this is going to start to snowball into bigger and bigger of a story.
Yeah.
People are going to sort of start to understand the stakes more and more. And that said, there is a real challenge by the fact that it's not going to be in front of anyone's eyes, really.
So, no matter what, Trump is stuck in that courtroom for the foreseeable future. Judge Marchand is not letting him go, at least not for anything but an extremely special occasion, right?
I mean, he wants to go to Barron's graduation, and Judge Marchand said, put a pin in that.
Which I've seen a lot of conservative Trump defenders saying that's insane and outrageous, but we should remind people that is how criminal trials work. The defendant does not get to pick and choose which calendar days he or she attends. You've got to be there pretty much the whole time.
It's very typical. And he also wants to be there for Supreme Court arguments, which I know you are probably going to.
Yes, lucky me.
This upcoming week for the immunity case.
That's right.
Trump's attorneys argued on his behalf how big of a deal it is that he's being argued in front of the Supreme Court and as a criminal immunity, it could impact this case, it could impact all these other things. Judge Marchand was like, I don't think it's going to impact this case, A. B, no, you can't go. Just nope, basically. And he's very terse, and he sometimes will have a little bit of, pondering in his responses. But then when he decides something, he's just, boom, on to the next issue.
Yeah, I mean, you and I wrote a piece about why the immunity case does not even apply here, right? And why Judge Marchand refused to consider it, because Trump only raised it at the 11th hour as a delay tactic. It's not sort of his number one shield as it is in these other cases.
That and the crime itself is private conduct, right? It's not presidential conduct. It's all cover up of payment to Stormy Daniels, who he supposedly had this affair with many, many years ago and didn't want voters to know about it. That's what it's, this doesn't have to do with anything with being president, I don't think.
So Trump is stuck in that chair. He's trying to find a face that communicates not guilty to the jury, and a face that shows to the public through a courtroom sketch artist that he is the defiant victim of a witch hunt. How do you think he's doing?
I think he's doing himself no favors with his demeanor in front of those jurors. And I've said that previously. I think he is not offering a pleasant demeanor to most of these jurors, and some he's being outright hostile towards and almost aggressive towards him. But he's making persistent eye contact. He's looking at people. And then when he gets out of the courtroom, you know, he does his normal campaign, this is a witch hunt, everybody's against me, blah, 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 spiel.
Last question, Jeremy. We've grabbed you for this taping before you go back into court on Friday. So caveating your predictions with a little time-sensitive asterisk. You are an astute legal observer, but not entirely clairvoyant. Tell us, what are you watching out for next week, and what should we be doing our homework on?
So next week's going to be a big week. It's going to be the start of the trial. You're going to have Monday. Proceedings will actually begin in earnest. You might have opening arguments from the prosecution, which they'll lay out their entire theory of the case, which they've already started to do a little bit, both sides in jury selection, previewing their cases to the jurors as part of their voir dire process. But you'll really have the story that each side is going to tell once that happens. You also have this question of the gag order violations and the contempt, which is going to happen on Tuesday. And Judge Marchand does not appear to be too inclined to be friendly to, based on his previous comments, Trump's position that these were innocent remarks and that he has to defend himself, et cetera. He even noted to Todd Blanche on one of the early days of the trial, did I misread the gag order? Is there something in there that I put about it's okay for him to say these things if he's just defending himself? Sarcastically, obviously. And, you know, I don't think Blanche knew what to say to that. That will happen. And at that point, if Trump continues to violate that gag order, I don't know what the escalation is going to look like, but it's going to be something serious. Also, we'll start to see who the first witnesses are in terms of telling that story. So we'll have a early witness list and just a preview of the witnesses for the week. This thing's happening.
So much to look forward to and so much to dread. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Jeremy Stahl is Slate's jurisprudence editor and our Law of Trump chief correspondent.
Hey, Slate Plus members. Mark and I will see you in a minute in the Amicus Plus subscribers only bonus episode, your weekly dose of a little bit of extra SCOTUS analysis. This week, we're talking about the January 6th case that the court heard on Tuesday and the employment discrimination case that came down that wasn't actually horrible in terms of the future of Title VII. If you are not a Slate Plus member, you can listen to that episode now by joining our ever-growing merry band of Slate Plus subscribers. Not only will you be able to unlock exclusive SCOTUS analysis in bonus episodes of Amicus, but you will also be able to access ad-free listening across all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts by clicking Try Free at the top of our show page, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. And that is a wrap for this week's episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening in, and thank you so very much for your letters and your questions. You can keep in touch at amicus@slate.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/amicuspodcast. Do not forget to buy your tickets for our live show, May 14th at 6 and I in Washington, D.C. Go to slate.com/amicuslive to snag tickets and get more details. And we will pop a link into the show notes. See you there. Sara Birmingham is Amicus's senior producer. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio at Slate. Susan Matthews is Slate's executive editor. And Ben Richmond is our senior director of operations. We'll be back with another episode of Amicus next week. And until then, hang on in there.